All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What's happening? Where are you at? How you feeling? I am going to talk to Ari Aster today. He's a film director. He's the writer and director of Hereditary, Midsommar, and Beau is Afraid. His new movie, Eddington, is now in theaters, shot in my home state of New Mexico. Also, Ari Aster's home state. Challenging movie, man, but kind of great. It's kind of great to see a movie that is provocative, challenging, and not seamless in a way. Not, you know, the narrative of it, the story of it. It hinges on a story, but it's what happens on the peripheries of the story and the characters within the story and their sort of sub-stories and psychological character defects and pluses that make it very interesting. It really is about, it's a very sort of isolated small town in New Mexico at the precipice of the world changing because of COVID and what that did to people's brains, what it did to politics, you know, where it brought people's brains. And it also deals with the sort of weird humanness at the core of it all. But somehow or another, he tends to mash all the forces that were upon us during that time. The Trump presidency, the Black Lives Matter protests, police action, masks, no masks, paranoia, radical politics that came out of it, government dubiousness. And just he takes on everything on a very intimate level through people and through small town dynamics. And the sort of broader idea is that this small town at its, you know, a big story point is whether they should build this data cloud, I guess, what I don't know what you call them, cloud storage facility, you know, the thing that stores everything that makes us crazy. I highly recommend it. You will probably have to see it twice. That said, this Thursday, July 31st, I'll be at the 92nd Street Y in New York City in conversation with Jim Gaffigan after a screening of my HBO special, Mark Maron Panicked. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for links to tickets. Panicked premieres the next day on HBO and streaming on HBO Max, and that's also the release date of The Bad Guys 2. Also, new cat mugs from Brian R. Jones go on sale today at noon Eastern. These are the handmade mugs I give to my guests. This is the second to last batch he's making, so you only get two more cracks at this. Go to WTFmugs.co at noon Eastern today for the famous Brian Jones mug. Been doing a lot of press for Bad Guys. Full junket. Went to Comic-Con for the first time. They aired us in. They chartered a plane to take the entire cast in to do, I guess it's the big H room. I don't know. You know, I'm not a Comic-Con. It was the big room, about 5,000 people in there. And me and the rest of the cast were all there doing the thing and, you know, doing the talk. Got some laughs, showed some trailers. This movie is pretty dynamic for an animated thing. And I'm not an animated guy, but it's a seat rumbler, man. It's going to be good for the kids. And I think even the grownups will like it. And I'm not supposed to say that, but I believe it's true. It's a pretty exciting thing. So look, I do want you to know I'm reeling it in, people. I'm reeling it in. All right. Look, I know I've been a lot the last couple weeks, maybe for the last 16 years. You know, it was a lot for me, too. I've had enough of myself as well. Believe me, I'm exhausting, mostly to me. So I empathize with you if you've had enough of my anxiety trajectory in the last couple weeks. I get it. It just happens sometimes. What can I tell you? I mean, it's just the way my brain is. Everything's coming in hot, and I couldn't stop any of it from making impact and detonating fires. So be it. That is the way my brain works. Eventually, like today, maybe yesterday, maybe happened the day before, possibly even last Wednesday, eventually I reel it in, all right? I compartmentalize. I assess what is really happening against what is disastrously speculative, and I just try to shut down the shit generator, the psychic shit generator, all right? And I'm having some success. As of this speaking, I'm having some success for today, all right? I think it's just my mind. It's just the way my mind prepares for change, prepares for challenges. And once the fires settle down, I can sort of parse what needs to be done, break that shit down into steps to be taken and get a fucking handle on it. With the help of a few good friends who understand the dryness of the forest of my mind. And at any time, there might be a problem and we might need to contain the fires. Got to have a couple guys for that. And maybe a therapist. I have two guys, a therapist and a girlfriend that is, you know, I think getting more exhausted as each day goes by, as they all do, understandably. But look, I mean, I imagine that most people have some version of this process. It's just that I yammer about it and I have a lot of different things going on and not more than other people. I'm not, you know, saying that you know, my problems are more than others. Some people have bigger and more difficult lives than me, certainly. But it's just the way my brain works. I've always wanted to be a smoother character, folks. You know, maybe a cowboy of some kind, you know? Yeah, well, maybe I am, actually. Maybe I'm like half bull rider and half rodeo clown. And that means I'm just riding or distracting bulls of my own making. This sort of psychological bulls in the mental rodeo ring of my fucking brain. But look, I think I feel better for a couple of reasons. Yeah, I'm making some decisions about Charlie. You know, I do have to be away a bit and I was going to board him. I know there was talk of giving him away, but I'll hang on. I love the guy and it's just too much. Yesterday I came home, there was, you know, tufts of hair everywhere, piss, blood. He's just, he cannot get past his Buster obsession, his beat the shit out of Buster obsession. So I was going to board him, but I said, dude, just board him in your house. I texted Jackson Galaxy. And I think it's going to be okay for a few days, and then I'll deal with it more hands-on when I get home and decide whether or not I need to put him on Prozac or how to fucking, you know, deal with the problem more efficiently. But to keep him separated, to keep him occupied, he's got plenty of room in my room, and I just want to be away and have peace of mind and not spend the day waiting to hear whether or not my cats are killing each other. That's part of my life. And I also think I feel better because I think I had a major breakthrough last week. All right, look, you guys know this. I've been playing guitar for a long time, mostly alone, all right? Over the last few years, as some of you know, I've started to play with other musicians on stage because it was something I wanted to do like my whole life. But I never pursued it like that. But I wanted to do it confidently. I think I'm an okay guitar player, but the confidence just never came. You know, when I play with other people, I would feel okay about the gigs and the playing and the singing, but just not great and not really relaxed. I would be very hard on myself after the show and during the show. Look, I mean, I believe that I have a lane that I can be in as a singer and player. And again, I'm not trying to be a professional musician, okay? And I don't expect to be like as good as a professional musician, although I do play with professional musicians. But I'm very hard on myself, primarily because I want to feel like I do it well for me. And these are things, like, as you get older, to try new things and to take the next step with things that you've been doing all your life, or try to, you know, take a hobby or even a whole new thing, just try it. You know, I'm not talking about jumping off mountains or hang gliding. Maybe that's something that you can, you know, get better at. But I'm talking about creative endeavors. It's scary. It's scary. And as a player and a singer, I fucking choke on stage all the time. I lose my place. I lose the words. I screw up the chords. My throat tightens up and I don't sing well. It's fucking annoying. And I just want to be good at something immediately. Who doesn't want to just be good at something immediately? I mean, I play all the time. Why can't I just be good at something with other people and in front of people? Why can't I just do it immediately? I mean, after every gig that are supposed to be fun, you know, I generally feel like I don't really need to do it again. Like I'm lying to myself. What's the point of it? I can't really play well enough. I'm not a good enough singer. I fucking choke. It's fucking annoying. But I made some progress. My friend Paige Stark, who I've played with and sung with in the past. We did a song together for that Love LA compilation. And she kept bugging me. She kept saying, I got these guys that I play with that, you know, will get you. They get you. I know that, you know, I get where you're coming from, you know, as a musician. And maybe we should put these guys together. And I play with guys who are good. You know, Ned and Brandon, Jason, sometimes Jimmy Vivino. And we have a good time. But I always felt like, okay, so we kind of crammed together a couple of rehearsals, pick a bunch of songs, just do our versions of it. I think the most time we spent on a song was probably Warfrat by the Grateful Dead. But, you know, it's like I want to feel like I'm really doing the work. It's like me in acting. These are new things for me, really, in the big picture of my life. And I want to feel like I'm doing the work so I can get better, you know, and be more consistent with it. So I relented, and I told the other guys that I'm going to play with this other group of musicians. It was Luke Paquin, Dan Horn, Jerry Borges. And we rehearsed, like we really rehearsed. You know, before I was just kind of jamming out loose versions of covers that I just wanted to do my way, you know, just sloppy and easier. And we would rehearse, like I said, a couple of times, a few days before the gig. Basically, it was good enough for rock and roll. I just never felt like I was really like doing the work to become better. Like, you know, really kind of doing the rehearsing and the practicing. You know, I always had the lyrics on paper in front of me, and I knew the guys would carry me. And I had fun, kinda, but I wanted to really rehearse and learn the process of making choices about songs and working them and getting the hours in to nail something that sounded like well rehearsed. I mean, that's how you get good. And I know I have to suck to get good, but I'm kind of tired of sucking, you know, in my mind. And people appreciate the effort, and I'm very self-effacing when I do these music shows on stage. And, you know, I'm kind of taking the piss out of it because, you know, I'll fuck up and stuff and then have a monologue around that and I'll fuck up the lyrics and I'll have the lyrics in front of it, whatever. So I started practicing with these with this new group of musicians and we did it. And I think I broke through to some other place, some higher place for me as a musician and singer. Like, I learned all the words to all the songs we covered. That's a first. I learned and rehearsed the structures of the songs, honoring originals a bit more than I usually do. And it just all paid off. I didn't choke. I didn't have the lyrics in front of me. I didn't make myself crazy. And I had fun. And I did pretty well, I think, all around. The band was great. But the real fucking doozy of the night, I don't know. You know, I'm not a normal person. And sometimes I look back at the choices I make. And I'm like, why would you even try to do that? What would you do? Why would you do that? I decided to cover the Taylor Swift song that had a profound impact on me in terms of sitting with grief. I do a whole big bit on it in my special, which I told you premieres this Friday, August 1st on HBO. The song is bigger than the whole sky. And I wanted to cover it. And we decided the arrangement would be kind of like Mazzy Star-ish. And it just fucking broke me. But my throat was open. Like I was singing from my guts and it was kind of amazing. Like I made it through the last verse, you know, almost. And then I choked up. I didn't choke. I choked up. It was pretty raw. And on the last, you know, chorus, you know, it was pretty raw. It was very emotional, but it landed and I felt pretty good about it. And there's actually a reel of it on Largo at the Coronet's IG page. If you want to watch me kind of do something that is the most terrifying thing in the world to me. And I actually think that breakthrough, just the creative one, might have helped, you know, lighten the load of all the other anxiety I was feeling. And I think that may be the cross to bear of the creative person. Is that you need it to live. You know what I'm saying? So Ari Aster is here, and I watched all his movies, and all of them are unique, all of them are challenging, all of them are kind of provocative, and he's a real auteur, a real artist, a guy with a vision that will, you know, he'll manifest his vision as he sees it, and that's a rare gift. And he's got the gravitas to do it after his first couple movies, and he's doing it. And this new movie, Eddington, is now playing in theaters, and it's not a horror movie. He's done a couple horror movies. He's done sort of a 3-hour lyrical ode to panic. That's pretty challenging in and of itself. But challenging movies are where it's at. That's the problem with this movement towards a Christian nation, is that, you know, the type of Christians that want to take over this country are myopic and fucking boring. And anything that's different to them, that doesn't fit into their purview, deserves punishment or just complete disappearance. And it's movies like these, and also things like the new South Park episode, or things like people speaking out through art or through their platforms, that is much needed. In the big picture, it may not stop the authoritarianism we're living in, but it does keep the human voice alive and human creativity alive. It was a pleasure talking to Ari, and now you can listen to it as well. You nervous? No.
I'm always nervous to be recorded.
Are you?
Yeah, what am I going to say that's going to haunt me forever, you know?
Oh, really? So you've got that paranoia. I mean, I do too. And now that I'm finishing the podcast, you know, I'm out in the wild. I have a producer generally that protects me from myself because he edits.
Okay.
So he'll say like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't say that. But now I'm just out in the wild talking shit. And it makes me nervous.
How long have you been unprotected?
Well, no, I mean, the podcast, we're wrapping up in a couple months, but I've been doing a lot of promotion for my HBO special, and I'm doing podcasts, and I'm talking about the state of comedy. I'm talking about politics. But the truth of the matter is that only a few people really at a certain level are going to give a shit, and it'll probably disappear in 3 days. Whatever
that is true, especially with the nature of just, I mean,
it's just
everything.
It just goes away eventually, unless it really sticks.
But people also love to go digging.
Yeah, right.
You know, so whenever, you know, like whenever there's something new by somebody,
yeah,
it's always a nice pastime to dig through their archives and see what pisses you off.
Well, right, but I mean, but you just made a movie that was, you know, designed to piss people off in a very specific way on some level. Maybe not designed to piss people off, but at least to be provocative on all fronts.
Yeah.
So you're fortunate in that it succeeds in that. So, you know, everybody can kind of pick and choose what they like or what they're pissed about.
That's right.
You know, to see it as a whole, I think is a daunting but exciting task.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up really loving just art that was provocative, but I didn't have the internet, and so it's a very different world.
Well, yeah, because things can be taken apart and recontextualized immediately.
Yeah,
and
it's all about just like casting your own, like your, like finding your stance.
So that's right.
I feel like there's like, you know, how would I say this? The responsibility of like the audience or the viewer or the reader is different now than it used to be. I think it should be, I think, and I feel this way when I walk into a theater.
Yeah,
it's like I want to submit.
Yeah.
To whatever the thing is.
Yeah,
but now it's so much about, you know, you sit there and you have to find your take. And then you have to cast it because you're also, everybody's just, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true. But it's self-serving because, yeah. I mean, finding the take thing, and then you've got these sort of amateur or relatively popular critics or political pundits who are going to use your work, you know, fragmented in order to make their point and generate attention for themselves.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of functional art criticism or film criticism doesn't exist that much anymore.
Yeah.
And I know you grew up in New Mexico, right?
Yeah. I was born in New Jersey, in Princeton, New Jersey, but I spent like a week there. And then I was a baby in New York.
Yeah.
And then my parents moved to England for a few years, to Chester, which is near Wales.
Why?
My dad wanted to start a jazz club.
Did he do it?
It didn't happen, no. But then we all moved when I think I was seven.
Yeah.
I must have been seven. And then we all moved to New Mexico, to Santa Fe. And then he started a jazz festival that lasted for a few years.
I was just there. I just bought this ring.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I grew up in Albuquerque, and I, too, was born in New Jersey.
I know that. I know that. Is that turquoise?
Of course.
Oh, man. You fell for it. I can't believe it.
It's a big one. Well, this one I've had for years. This is a Zuni ring. As I got older, for some reason, because I grew up there, I felt that I wanted to have something attached to it. It's not really, yeah. I mean, I dig this shit. And the truth of the matter is, as far as jewelry goes, turquoise silver, kind of a native jewelry, is relatively inexpensive to get kind
beautiful.
Of a big chunky piece. I'm not sure if this is too big or not, but I'm going to try to rock it.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. Turquoise is like, I had to really restrain myself from using it in Eddington. It felt like just too...
It's kind of back.
No, of course. Yeah. I mean, it never left, I don't think.
You didn't want to put one squash blossom on somebody's chest? You know, just the dangling U of turquoise?
I'm realizing I probably should have relented, because it is just important. Like, how do you do without...
It's the only place it really exists. Sometimes it moves to Texas, and then occasionally it shows up out here when there's a southwestern trend going on. But it is definitely part of New Mexico.
A huge part of it, especially Santa Fe.
Oh, yeah. I got it right on the plaza, too. And it's got a kind of an exciting backstory, this ring. The artist, who is Zuni, has passed away. And the stone is from a mine that's been closed. So this is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's got a whole
back. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
I know you're from Albuquerque. That's where my family lives now.
Really?
When I was an adolescent, I grew up in Santa Fe. But in Corrales.
Oh, of course they do.
Yeah.
Like, have they been there a long time?
They've been there since, the year before I went to college, which was the College of Santa Fe, they moved to Corrales. So they've been there for 20 years now.
I grew up down the street. I grew up off of Rio Grande, right Northwest Valley.
Wow. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I know.
Do you remember, I don't know how long ago, were the Buffaloes there when you were growing up? On Rio Grande, there was a guy that owned a herd of buffaloes. You know, right past Los Poblanos, where the big curve is on Rio Grande, if you're coming west, there used to be an actual herd of buffalo there that a guy owned. They're gone now. You missed that, huh?
They must be, yeah. They still got the balloons.
Sure, the balloons are there, yeah. Do you feel a connection in New Mexico?
You know, when I was there, as a kid, I resented the place, and I did not like it. And I think that has to do with having, had like New York in my system. And And so I didn't like it. But now when I go to visit family, when I go home, I really appreciate it in a new way. And shooting the film, I mean, the entire process of making the film was really, it brought me back to it. And I really enjoyed it, you know.
Well, it's beautiful. And I think you did a good job capturing New Mexico. But so.
Thank you.
What, your folks were both in the arts?
Yeah. My mom is a visual artist who is a poet. She kind of moved from printmaking to painting and
printing at home or doing like high-end printing, like going down to Albuquerque to do prints at Tamarind or something.
Well, it was in New York that she was a printmaker.
Yeah.
And then she became a poet.
Yeah.
And she's been a poet for a long time.
How's she doing with that?
Good. She has had a book published and she's published several books and I think she's a great poet.
You do?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
she's great. She's really, I would say her work can be like punishing.
Okay. Oh, really?
In a good way. I'm her son.
punishing. I'm a guy who, in my past, if anyone went digging, has written some poetry. And, I thought myself a poet in college. And, what is punishing?
Oh, well, let me amend that, because I didn't have the time to really find the words. I think her stuff is very, is very honest and like unvarnished and painful.
Okay.
And I find it funny too, like very funny.
In terms of personal vulnerability? And the honesty and the pain, like, when you read her poems, you can see parts of her that you're like, wow, that's happening inside my mom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just recognize my mom in the writing.
Yeah.
I think her work is great.
And your dad's a jazz guy?
My dad is a jazz drummer. Yeah.
Great.
And when he was younger, he was on the road with
really
for a period. He was with the OJs.
Okay.
Playing the drums.
Uh-huh. So he's a touring musician.
He was, yeah.
So you had that element in your house, the lounge act element.
Yeah. That's right. I think he tried to make me a musician, and I guess I rebelled.
But I think really what's amazing, because, you know, in watching the movies, which I crammed a lot of them in, you know, and I've seen all the feature films of yours, because I don't like, first of all, I'm not generally a horror guy.
Me neither.
No, I know. I'm starting to understand that. But I got it all in there, and it strikes me that your sense of freedom in terms of doing the movie you want to do, you had to come from some confidence in what, you know, art is. And it seems that you grew up with that. That in a house full of artists, yeah, certainly a drummer who was maybe not a free jazz drummer, but yeah. The power of improvisation and honoring your own vision was kind of ingrained, I would assume.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to give my parents and especially my mother credit that, you know, you know, when I was a baby, she would give me, you know, crayons and put me on like butcher paper and.
But I assume like you were like educated in like you know my mom was kind of a painter at one point, and there was a lot of going to the Museum of Modern Art and seeing the stuff and having your mind blown by art that was so ingrained in the family, you know, fabric, or at least my mom's desire to paint. You know, it gave me a sort of wonder and awe of art.
Yeah.
Did you have that?
Yeah, I definitely had that. My mother is a tough critic, and she gave me that too.
Yeah.
She, you know, like I would as a kid like take her to a movie that I thought was good.
Yeah.
And she would, you know, she didn't think it was good. She'd be like, "You thought that was good?
Really?
That was bullshit."
And do you find that she's right, or do you argue?
Oh yeah. No, I think that was really hugely useful, because it from a very young age made me I think maybe at a certain point I was probably too censorious for my own good.
Yeah.
Like, just like not really,
right.
You know, just like that thing I was talking about, right, where it's like, are you submitting to the work and are you really giving yourself to it and giving it a chance to come into you? And that there was probably a period at which, you know, I wasn't allowing the work in. But I would say, you know, a lot of my taste was adopted from hers.
And from being critical and understanding the depth of any sort of, you know, final piece.
You know,
because you can be jacked around by art and you can be stunned, whether it's a film or a poem or, you know, a painting.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of times when you're younger, you're like, that's amazing. And they're like, no, this is garbage.
Yeah.
And then you have to be like, why? And then all of a sudden the depth of your kind of aesthetic understanding grows.
Yeah.
And you realize like, okay, all right, this is the context of how I have to see art.
Yeah.
And you were given that by your mother.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have a lot of memories of seeing certain films with her in theaters that were like, you know, formative.
Right. Like what?
I would say the big ones, the big memories I have were like, we were both kind of blown away. And it was really nice to like kind of share that experience.
Yeah.
Would be Songs from the Second Floor by Roy Anderson.
Uh-huh.
That was huge. The Piano Teacher.
Yeah.
I think I was 15 when I went to see that. And that was huge.
Yeah.
You know, Mulholland Drive, her favorite movie is Defending Your Life. And that has, you know, that's for me just a perfect movie.
Albert Brooks movie.
I love Albert Brooks.
Comedically,
so
oh, me too. Comedically, there are beats in that movie that if I think about them right now, I'll laugh. There are, because Brooks, like, you know, he'll put together, like, each scene is going to be a comedic scene. And sometimes they string together well, and sometimes it doesn't matter. You know, but there are beats in that movie that are just spectacular.
There's Shirley MacLaine in the Past Lives Pavilion where she goes, "Hi, I'm Shirley MacLaine." And you hear the woman in the back going, "Oh, my God." She's like so scandalized. That's so funny. Just, yeah, he's like a master of like the prolonged, like extended scene, like a scene that goes for like 10, 15 minutes, but doesn't die.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That, and all of it's sort of founded in his ability to stretch out a comedic beat.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sort of, it's not even a tension he creates, but there's a kind of like, going back and forth with him that, you know, he can just keep going and really deliver all the way through. But that beat in Defending Your Life where, you know, he's like, where they're showing him his shortcomings.
Oh, yeah.
And the scene where he's going to, you know, ask for the raise.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you $20,000. I'll take it.
Yeah, I'll take it. Like right away, the first thing. And even the guy is disappointed. Even the guy who's like getting ready to.
That's it.
To negotiate.
Yeah. Oh, it's so funny. That's so funny. He was such a big influence, but not just comedically, but filmically.
Oh, I think he's just, I think he's one of the great directors. I love those scenes.
Oh, my God. Have you told him?
Yeah. Oh no. I have told him, and I wrote a bunch of stuff for. Or I wrote two big pieces for Criterion about his work, and so he read those and then reached out to me, and he liked those pieces, and that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it means a lot to him. You know, that you did that.
Oh my God!
Because I think he does feel a bit underappreciated.
Does he still? Because I feel like the reassessment has. I mean, I hope he feels appreciated. I know so many filmmakers that, you know, just worship at the
at
the altar.
That's great because it's surprising. I wouldn't have assumed that. If you watch that doc on him with Rob Reiner, you know, there are every turn the movies do not do as well.
Yeah.
So that's
Rob Reiner. You know, I mean, this is Spinal Tap, right? Which comes like I don't know 5 years after. Or more after Real Life,
right?
And Real Life was the first
best,
of those.
The best. That's that beat in where you know where you clearly see Grodin, you know, ask for the extra shot, goes, "Can we not put that?" I mean, where he kills the horse, and Brooks is like, "No, I think it's going to be
right." Where he's a veterinarian, and it's too much anesthesia, I think.
Yeah. He asked for it twice or something.
It's so good.
But what seems to be happening. In terms of independent filmmakers in a real sense, or people with a vision, that for some reason right now, horror seems like a decent kind of genre to really figure out, you know, whatever you want.
Yeah.
In terms of how you want to make a movie, that the horror thing is just sort of a framework, but you can go a lot deeper with a lot more freedom as opposed to just, you know, do a movie that's not a genre film.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if your sensibility is on the darker side, it's a very good genre to be working in.
Yeah,
I might have even taken it a little bit for granted because these last two films that I've made, you know, have left the genre and have not reached the same audience.
The way they build Hereditary was this is going to be the scariest movie ever. So and a lot of horror people, you know, really took to it. So, I mean, that's a built-in audience of very specific people.
Yeah, and I say that I'm not like a horror guy, but that's not necessarily true. I love horror films. I just, it's not, you know, I feel like there are certain people who like, you know, almost exclusively watch horror movies. Like, that's all they're interested in. And that's not me. I love a good horror movie. I think, you know, when those films are like working, they're thrilling.
Yeah.
And they can feel dangerous in a really exciting way. But I would say I just find that because it's a genre that kind of traditionally does do well I find that it attracts a lot of like cynical people.
Yeah.
And a lot of those films just feel cynical to me and just feel kind of like I get bored easily.
That's the interesting thing about Hereditary is that you have this story, you know, the story of a cult, you know, that you don't know is a cult until later in the movie. But that ultimately is not what the movie is essentially about, right? So you use this template to kind of explore whatever you want. And a good horror movie, you know, may do that, you know, not necessarily on purpose. They're provocative in a certain way. But it seems like with all the movies, there's a layering of the frailty of humans, but also, you know, family issues, you know, tragedy issues. So the backstories of the characters are much more in depth than just, you know, putting horror out there to sort of time fear.
Yeah, I hope so. I tend to believe that the more invested you are in the story or the people, you know, the especially when you're making a horror film, which is, you know, kind of essentially, you know, I think at its best, like kind of based on betrayal and, yeah. and kind of like you're, it's like, what's going to happen to these people?
Right.
And if the people are just ciphers, like who gives a shit?
Yeah.
But if you are invested, then suddenly it can become a really complicated, like upsetting, experience. And so that's I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
But then I realize when I leave the genre, it's like, I'm still kind of doing that.
Well, the through line all the way to this film, like even at the core of Eddington, in the middle or at the heart of all this, you know, political conflict and you know, sort of social conflict is trauma.
Yeah.
On some level. I mean, do you read that?
Yeah, I do. And I think in some ways it's like quicksand that people get stuck in.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, you know, I think especially at this moment where like the present is so unpleasant and it's so difficult to even think about the future.
And also there's so many forces at hand that are destroying people's minds. The mind is very vulnerable.
Exactly. I think in you know, it's very plastic. And I would say, you know, at this moment, it feels like people are really retreating into either nostalgia or trauma. Right. But it's always it's the past.
And also
right?
to
make sense of the present. Yeah. No, of course.
Yeah.
I said president to make sense of the present.
Yeah. But the past is mythic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like in Hereditary, you're dealing with this, you know, psychological trauma that, you know, is not the turn doesn't happen till like almost what, you know, a third, you know, halfway through the movie.
Yeah.
And so you're just dealing with this family that is strained beyond understanding because of the mother's, you know, experience with her own mother and her mother's passing. And also, like I was talking to my producer yesterday, you know, the decision to make her art, you know, some sort of strange, attempt at control by creating these miniature, you know, lives and houses and everything was sort of interesting. I mean, and when you make a decision like that to like, all right, this character is an artist and this is the art she does.
Yeah.
Do you have intention there or you just thought it was cool?
Oh no, of course. I mean, there's intention there. There's a character in Eddington played by Emma Stone who's doing kind of the same thing.
With the little dolls.
There's something that she doesn't even really have access to because it's so painful.
Right.
But it's coming out in these distorted ways.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I find those dolls are, you know, the most access we have to her inner life.
Yeah. And then the rest is suggestion.
Yeah. The rest is suggestion. And my hope is that there's enough there that you can kind of put it together, but you're with her husband who doesn't really understand her and who's kind of afraid to understand her. I think he senses like the depth of, you know, maybe what has happened to her.
Yes.
But he doesn't want to face it. And so because he's our surrogate, you know, she's kept at a remove. And so I wanted her to be kind of ghostly, but I wanted there to be enough that was, you know, evident to us that you know, even just on a strictly emotional level, that we have a strong sense of her. And I think that's a really hard thing for an actor to work with.
To play the damage and not let on.
Yeah, and not do something that's obvious and not like telegraph anything. I just think what she does in the film is really special and very subtle.
You know? Oh, yeah. No, it's great. It just seems to me, first of all, in Hereditary, there, you know, the way you There were definitely, you know, horror tropes that were identifiable. It always seems that when a cult, the cult members always look like your neighbors or the guy who works at the hardware store. I like that element because I said that to my girlfriend who's a horror freak. I'm like, they always, like, Lynch does that too. It's not that they're normal people, but they're almost like an amplified normal. Like, you know, just these regular kind of school teacher looking.
Right,
in
kind
a way.
Of schlubby.
Yeah. But it's like, it seems like you have to do that. They have to be that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the more that you bring the mundane into it, the more disturbing it gets.
Yeah, because the mundane becomes horrifying. Yeah. But I like the way you played all that with the corpses and everything else. I just want to, like, the way I read that final scene, you know, because it was brutal that you decapitate the daughter before you know what's going on. But I enjoyed that.
Me too.
And then when you had the mother kind of using that in her artwork, you know, that was a moment of honesty, you know, for her to try to grapple with her life. But it seems to me that the torment of the teenage kid and the relationship with his mother and her sort of overbearingness and then, you know, borderline abuse, that I really felt that the final shot of the movie, that there was something I read into that moment where he becomes possessed by the demon, where he has this look in a very kind of a sweet way, like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. there was confusion. There was a little bit of like, you know, this is fucked up. But there was also like, wow, this is a high point in my teenage life.
Oh, I like that. I like that. I feel like he's almost like been lobotomized. But yeah, he's
no. But I just
been
felt like
wiped out. But
right,
yeah.
But the arc of the character and the struggles that he's had, like, you're like, is it going to work out for this teenage kid who's had a hard time with girls and he's trying to have friends and he's like the weed guy and then all this shit starts happening. But there was just this moment where it's like, oh man, this is fucking cool.
Yeah, it was a bumpy road for him. But
yeah, right.
But you know, at
but
least
he gets to be a demon.
Yeah, he's king now.
Yeah. Did you feel that?
I definitely like the idea of having an ending that almost feels like triumphant.
Yeah.
And where the catharsis is, there's like an emotional catharsis where it feels like something has come to fruition.
Yeah.
And where that, you know, the horror of what that thing is sort of underneath the tone, which is telling you something else.
Right.
I do like a complicated tonal
ending.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same with Midsommar because, like, you know, after all you go through with that film, you kind of feel good for her.
Yeah.
Like, she's arrived. You know, she's where she needs to be.
That's right.
And it's going to be okay. She's the May Queen.
That's right. She's another person who's been utterly wiped out. But, you know, it is a triumph.
And that was a clear path, you know, because you went into the horror of her tragedy, you know, was graphic in the film, you know, to lose your family like that.
Yeah.
And then the sort of being shattered by grief and detachment like that and almost disassociating, you know, she, you know, that is a prime candidate for any sort of, you know, comforting support or to feel included. But I like that in that movie, you know, outside of the cult thing, that you did have that sort of horror trope of like, these kids are going to die.
Yeah. And that is just something that we take for granted. And that's something that I wanted the movie to take for granted.
Where right.
Like, okay, this is a horror movie about like American kids in another, you know, who are going to an exotic country.
Yeah.
We know how this works. They're all going to die. They have to die.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to like barely pay attention to that because we know that that's happening. So
right.
it was about somehow making that be done, like doing that so casually,
right?
That starts to get under your skin, where it's like, well,
how's it going to go?
And then it's all about like aftermath, right? Like, well, there are the bodies. Like, who cares?
You right?
Know? This is going to happen,
and also like the. But you play those characters, you know, when confronted, because you played the horror so I don't want to say realistically, but in a kind of almost beautiful and poetic way, right. that the humanity of these characters, when they're faced with, you know, that first turn, not unlike the decapitation in Hereditary, where that older couple jumps off the cliff because it's part of the ritual yeah. of this community, and that woman's face just blows apart. That the reactions of all these, you know, they're sort of like, oh, you know, one of them, well, I guess this is what they do, and you know, this is, we have to respect that. And then, and then there's the other sort of like, are you out of your fucking mind? Those are human responses that were not, you know, kind of hack in any way. You know, I feel like, you know, you really let them play those for real.
Oh, good. Well, I feel like that's important.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, that's sort of the fun of, well, is it the fun? It's the fun of genre filmmaking, but I find that the more I believe the behavior of people,
yeah.
the more immersed I am in the, you know, in the experience of the film. Like, you know, the minute that somebody is taking something in a way that I don't buy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's
annoying.
Like, it's like, well, it's just like, okay, so this is bullshit. I don't care.
Yeah, yeah. And the funny kid was really funny in that. The
Will Poulter?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Will. And Will's a really great guy. I love Will.
It's just like that. You didn't tell me we're going to Waco. I laughed out loud at that one.
Yeah.
And then when he pisses on the sacred tree.
Oh,
it's the
yeah.
best.
Yeah.
And then he just knew it was over. You know, like,
he doesn't quite know. He's just like,
he doesn't know right up into it. And and you kept a lot of the killing out of the frame. And then I guess a lot of people compare Midsommar to Wicker Man, but I didn't find that association, you know, bothersome or necessarily relevant.
Well, again, that was just one of the things that was like, you know, okay, I'm making this film in this genre. Like,
yeah.
I was approached by people to do that. It's like, okay, that's an inescapable film in like the folk horror
right.
genre.
Right.
And so you know, you nod to it and then you keep going.
Yeah.
But I find the films to be at their heart very, very different animals. And then and Wicker Man's an interesting one, cause I think it's just one of the best scripts like ever. It's just a perfect script.
Yeah.
Some of the execution is kind of goofy,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Especially the musical stuff. But I mean, I love that film.
Yeah, it's Well, no, I thought it was beautiful, and I really do think it's interesting at the end of both of those, you know, specifically genre horror movies. Like you're kind of like, oh, they're going to, good for them, you know. Like there is that in contrast to the horror, like you said, there is this element of deliverance for these characters that is not horrible somehow.
Yeah, I want the feeling to be really complicated. I want you to come out with something that you have to kind of wrestle with. And
sure.
Because I
may be being too surface about it, but it was just that vibe of like...
Well, no, I don't think you are. I think that's that I'm really interested in what... It's a very manipulative medium.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, anything where there's music involved, because music is so emotional...
Yeah,
like the minute you start using music, you're manipulating, whether it's for suspense or to make somebody, you know, whatever it is, alone. Just,
right.
And then you have certain filmmakers who like kind of devoted themselves to avoiding manipulation, which you can't do. Like even, you know,
the nature of it,
people like Bresson or.
Yeah, you know. Right. You can't really, because the nature of the construction is manipulative.
Yeah. And I think the way that Bresson went about it was essentially to just like alienate you as much as possible. You know, like those films are really fucking strange.
Yeah. So when you do like these movies, like Hereditary, and then like moving into Bo, I mean, do you find yourself resolving? You know, there's and I've done this with singers, I've done it with writers. I mean, how much, you know, of you is in that in terms of, you know, dealing with your mother? I mean, obviously with Bo is afraid, you know, this is like, I was thinking about it yesterday, where if you have an anxious mind, you know, to the point of paralysis, you know, what your mind will generate as possibilities for anything that you're afraid of is it's almost infinite.
Yeah.
And it seems like this is sort of an experiment in following all those trajectories to their most extreme, you know, arc or conclusion.
Yeah.
Like it's really, it may be a comedy, but it's the horror of anxiety that you're really living in, to the point where, you know, what's in his head, what isn't, right?
Yeah.
Now, are you that person?
Yeah. I'm very anxious. And I'm given to, you know, catastrophic thinking.
Me too. I just got diagnosed with obsessional anxiety. I'm full on catastrophic thinking. It's paralyzing.
Yeah, it is. I would say that I'm avoiding that diagnosis, but I could self-diagnose right now.
I didn't want it, but like as I get older, it's gotten sort of worse, and I was sort of like, well, I need to figure this out because, you know, it's sort of like I wish my imagination, I had more control over it so I could just, you know, make puppets or whatever, you know, or at least get out of myself. But it's all driven by catastrophic thinking, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And did you exercise anything with Bo?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, maybe to a point, I probably did exercise some stuff. In some ways, you don't even notice these things. Like sometimes things just like, you know, kind of drift off your shoulder and you don't ever see them go.
Right, that's true. It happens when you get older too. You give less fucks.
Yeah, it's just too exhausting.
Yeah,
it's just
it is.
I can't care about this anymore.
Well,
I've
been saying on stage recently that, like, you know, the sort of connection between depression and anxiety, from my observation, is that, like, if you're really anxious, eventually your brain will peak with it, and then your brain will be like, well, let's just be sad.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the resting plateau between anxiety episodes. It's just sadness. It's kind of comforting, you know, once you've depleted yourself with your catastrophic thinking.
Yeah, yeah, which is, at a certain point, you just get exhausted.
Yeah, and you're sort of like, oh, this is kind of sad, I guess.
Yeah, it all ends in depression.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But it's not only categorically like depression. It's really just the final stage of anxiety, you know, in its movement.
Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah.
I would say I toggle back and forth.
Yeah. But with Bo, you knew, like, this is the thing about all the movies and why I sense from the horror movies that, you know, you were executing a vision that you were going to free eventually from genre. And with Bo, right, you just sort of like, fuck it. Which is, you had to write that thing and then look at it and go like, this is it.
Yeah.
This is the movie.
Well, and it's, you know, and it's a comedy. You know, I want it to be funny.
Yeah. Well, no, there's definitely very funny parts in it, but there is that element.
I want it all to be funny, like, to be honest. It's just that it's got this weird structure where it kind of begins in like this like 40-minute like Rube Goldberg kind of like climactic.
Yeah.
Quick thing.
Right.
And it does this thing that, you know, anybody would talk you out of, which
right.
is if you're like, you don't make the movie slow down.
Yeah.
Like, movies are supposed to speed up.
Yeah.
And Bo is a movie that kind of begins in, like, a frantic, like, manic way, and then just, like, slowly grinds to this, like, you know.
But then it elevates into, you know, it starts in a very sort of, like, you know, frantic but very city-driven vibe.
Yeah.
And then it kind of like it moves into, you know, a type of almost theatrical, you know, props, and it almost starts. And then there's actually a play at the, like, it moves into this other zone where you're not even sure where you are or why you're there. But it may start in a frantic thing that doesn't really have resolution. But then when it does arc into resolution, it becomes this sort of like, you know, crazy theatrical piece.
Yeah.
So it does have a build.
Yeah, I hope so. And you know,
and you have the giant balls.
You have the giant balls. Those are important.
Yeah.
You gotta.
It could be a play. I was talking to my producer, Brendan. I said, because he thought that a lot of your stuff feels like you're kind of a playwright in a way.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess that one, I don't know, maybe like Ionesco.
Yeah, but still, that's some, but I thought I talked about the balls would be great on stage. You know, the big balls.
Oh yeah,
and he goes, yeah, like Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, that's right. That's that. That's yeah, and Bo is sort of like Seymour in that case.
Yeah,
yeah. I love the Little Shop of Horrors, and then and that's a film. Yeah, that's a film that you know kind of. Is supposed to have an Ouroboros quality where it begins
to eat
with
itself.
Him. Well, yeah, it's like it begins with him like emerging from the womb as
yeah.
a baby,
yeah.
and it ends with him going back into the womb. You know,
right? And, but there's also that sense of wiring at that moment that, like, you know, he was doomed from the get go.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way?
Well, I think we all are in a sense. It's,
yeah.
It's all about you know how you look at it.
But you seem pretty well adjusted. Maybe it's just you on the mic.
No, it's what we were talking about. I'm just tired now.
Oh
I'm
yeah.
Just, yeah. The it's I'm in the sadness.
But did you know? I mean, you have to know that these films are going like there's an element of what you're doing that is specific, and it's going to be kind of a challenge, and that's being diplomatic to most people.
Well, I guess I was surprised that Bo was
not a blockbuster.
Was considered well in a way. I didn't think it was going to be a blockbuster. I knew that it was very specific, and I knew that it was like kind of deliberately alienating in certain ways.
Yeah,
but I still, you know, the whole time I was making it, it was like everything here is designed to be funny in one way or another.
Right,
and so for me, it was just like this. I'm making like a giant epic.
Comedy. Yeah,
and like it's I want one of those. Like so for me it was like I can't believe I'm providing this thing that I am so hungry for. Like that's so exciting.
So this was your homage to Albert Brooks.
Well, I mean, you know, I think I became aware of like, you know, for instance, the influence of like Defending Your Life on like the very last scene, like pretty late in the game, like while we were, you know, cutting it together, I was like, oh yeah, like this is sort of, this is sort of nodding to that.
Yeah. But,
I mean, of course that's like so in my system. But you know, it's sort of, as far as comedy goes, you know, I'm a comedy guy. Like I love comedy. So, you know, I was thinking about Chris Morris and I was thinking about, I don't know. I was thinking about Naked Gun.
Yeah,
and I was,
sure.
you know, the Zuckers. You know,
yeah.
I was just thinking like, you know, I want to make something that is like a gag machine.
Yeah.
And I want it to go for as long as possible. And a lot of these jokes are very different and they kind of belong in different worlds, you know? So it's almost like we're jumping subgenres where it's like you're in the city. Okay. This is like, again, it's like Rube Goldberg, you know?
Sure.
And then you go into the
country.
Well, next you go into the suburbs.
Oh yeah.
Right, with Nathan Lane.
Yeah.
And my first idea for that was, I mean, the first script was much wackier.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to just have the Terms of Endearment like soundtrack playing, and it was just supposed to be like this.
Yeah.
Bizarre, you know, parody of of like, you know, like a suburban.
For some reason, I'm getting like, do you remember Natural Born Killers?
Of course, yeah.
There's a lot of comedy in that.
Yeah, that's a lot of like really rough comedy.
Yeah, like
yeah,
you know,
with like the laugh track while Rodney Dangerfield like beats his family.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really interesting film. I think Oliver Stone for like 10 years.
Yeah.
Starting with probably Talk Radio.
Right.
And then like peaking with JFK and Nixon,
yeah.
Like he was doing really interesting stuff.
He definitely did what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's definitely elements of the insanity of Natural Born Killers that heightened that genre, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely like everything in the kitchen sink. Like
yeah.
That thing
that's
is,
right.
That thing
Same
is.
Same with Bo, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very, very different films.
Right. Of course.
I hope that there's like sort of a sweetness to Bo.
Yeah. Well, I think Joaquin brings that. Like, you can't help it.
Yeah,
you know, like the way he plays, and even in Eddington. But ultimately, how did you feel about the reaction to Bo?
Well, I was pretty sad that it was kind of so like maligned.
Yeah.
And I there were a lot of people who, you know, kind of reached out to tell me that they loved it, and I really that helped. But yeah, no, it was a bummer because it was a huge, it was, you know, it lost money. And critically, I wouldn't say it was like reviled, but it was definitely like there was no consensus whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then I would say now it feels like I hear about it more and more from people, like, you know, and that it's like sort of being reassessed, which is nice because I love the film. I'm really proud of it. There are things that I might do differently if I did it now.
Yeah, like what?
Oh,
how do you correct a movie that's 3 hours?
Three hours long. I think while I was making it, I was really excited about, you know, how exhausting it was.
Yeah.
It was like supposed to be exhausting.
Yeah.
And that last hour is meant to be like a real gauntlet.
Yeah.
And you know, there are jokes where basically the joke is like
how long it's taking.
And like, you thought this was going to be something and it's a dick in an attic. Like it's not, it's like, I'm going to just completely deflate this
right.
whole thing. Which in some ways was, there was like an aspect of like parody there where
yeah.
it's like, you know, I've already become kind of like known for a certain thing and I'm going to like completely
something in the attic.
I'm going to upend it. Exactly.
Yeah.
The attic. We're going to go up into the attic.
Yeah.
And what's going to be there is going to be like just stupendously disappointing. You know what I mean? Just like, and I think, like I would say I would probably tighten the last hour in a certain way
yeah.
that I was not willing to in the edit there. But, you know, but these are, you know, I think these are all these things you take away after you release
yeah.
a film and you're just like, okay, it's out of my hands now. I can't really avoid people's reactions, responses. It's like, you know, you kind of learn something and you find like what you, decisions you made that you like, you know, no matter what the response, like
yeah.
you're proud of
yeah,
for
sure.
like sticking with.
Yeah, yeah.
And then certain things where you're like, I'm not sure if it was like worth losing that much of the audience
right.
for that decision.
Right, right.
That decision.
Yeah, yeah
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
how, you know.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's
the
like,
balance.
Yeah, like, it, like I think I ejected like a number of people from the theater that maybe like, you know, I could have used them.
With the balls like, in the attic, maybe?
with the big dick in the attic.
Yeah.
Which I think that's a good example of something where it's like, I think that's something I really wanted to do when I was like a teenager and
sure.
like maybe my early 20s.
It's yeah.
like something I really would have found funny then. And it was like, I was sort of doing it for him.
Oh, good. Yeah.
But then I think there's a point where I was like, you know, I think that's more for him than even for me at this point.
Right.
Like, where it's like, I like need to do something to,
yeah.
That's a bit of an exorcism, you know.
Yeah,
it's like
sure.
I always compulsively like drew these like dick monsters. I don't know what that would, you know, says
yeah.
about me.
Yeah.
Well,
it's fine.
I've hundreds or thousands of them
of dick monsters.
Yeah, it's just something that I just like
yeah.
went to. I was just
yeah.
like, I'm going to do this again. And so it felt like, you know, okay, I gotta.
This is the conclusion. This is where we land. This is the last dick monster.
It's almost for my friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, all right, here it is, guys.
Yeah, yeah. The guy who drew the dicks, he made a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I got to watch it again now.
Good. Please.
Yeah.
yeah. Get some friends in there.
But Eddington, I watched, and what compelled you, you know, what was the seed of it?
I mean, just like living in this country and
yeah.
in this world and, you know, and just, feeling, I don't know.
Well, like, it's kind of an exploration of when and where it broke the country and the brains of the people in it. In a lot of ways, where something was all of a sudden humans were taken out of the community of humans and sort of thrown into this, you know, kind of whirlwind of bullshit and politics and
yeah.
and all the sort of fear and anger that was residing in the human community had now had a place to sort of go with the propagandized bullshit and it was, you know, elevated into this you know, kind of divisive shit show, right?
Yeah.
And this was sort of the cauldron of that. And you picked, you know, a small town to kind of explore all of what was happening in early COVID that now defines the end of civilization as we know it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think anything started with COVID. I think COVID just felt like, you know, the moment at which like the door kind of slammed shut behind us, and it's like, oh shit, like,
something
we're stuck here now.
Something broke.
Something absolutely broke. I think it was a huge inflection point, and I think we're still living.
That's what I mean. Yeah,
we're still living through it. And it's I think the moment where we were like stranded for good, you know, like
yes.
It's just like, well, now we're stuck. And
but also,
how do we ever get out of this?
Right. But, you know, the real demon or the real sort of villain of the film is essentially propaganda.
Yes.
And, you know, people's inability to protect their minds or think rationally in a cauldron of fear. And yeah. And anger and what they grab onto, right?
Well, and we're living in this like hyper individualized, like, you know, achievement society.
Right. Where, everybody's like, their own brand.
Yeah. And we're self-exploiting.
Yeah.
And so we also have and identity is so important to us. And so, you know, these ideas we hold, these convictions we hold are like, they're so like, that's our self. That's our, but it's also like, but where are they really coming from us? Like,
well, but also,
like, are we really the source of those convictions, you know, like, or are we being fed these things?
Well, but they're markers of virtue on some level.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And they're not rooted in principle necessarily. That I just read a book about this and it was a very difficult book, but what, you know, his basic idea was that, you know, communities don't really, you know, function or exist anymore. That no. People are unto themselves, and what they are is just a series of markers that are identifiable as a part of a point of view that really have nothing connected to it.
Yeah,
and so that's a good that's an interesting idea that, you know, who are we serving? You know, I've noticed that with comedy too. I mean, if you're trying to get a clip to go viral, you know, you're not, your freedom of voice is really not part of it. It's how do I design this to be symbiotic with the corporate platform that's going to enable me to get this part of myself out there or how I want to be seen, right?
Yeah.
But I thought it was I saw a little bit of a review that you know, I watched the movie and I found it, I had to really think about it and think about the humanity at the core of it. And you brought in everything. You mean you brought in, you know, kind of a leftist young protesters. You brought in, you know, conspiracy theorists. You had a character in there played by Austin Butler that was definitely Russell Brand-like. And I don't know if that was the starting point for him.
He was Russell Brand, like, was one of several people
yeah.
that we were talking
and
about.
And you had, you know, the mother who was a conspiracy freak. And then you had this fairly impotent legacy sheriff.
Yeah.
Who's married to the old sheriff's daughter, who is indecisive, relatively, you know, mundane and not that principled,
yeah.
right? Who you know, evolves into, you see the brain break.
Yeah. And it's easy to forget, I think, because everything is so politicized immediately.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget, like, how much of the landscape, you know, we are projecting our petty shit onto, like,
yeah.
onto the architecture of reality.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and that's a very important part of the film is that everybody is fighting on what seem to be ideological grounds, like really important ideological grounds. But just beneath that is just a bunch of, you know, people living in a small town who have, like, you know, personal histories.
Yeah.
And
they get infected.
Yeah. And they're projecting.
But they're infected with information that's quelling their anger and quelling their fear and giving them definition.
Yeah.
But it's ultimately shallow. And I think that to play it in a small community was kind of great because, you know, it eventually infects them to the point where the community is impossible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I just, I thought, like, well, the framing was that it's a Western.
Yeah.
Were you conscious of that?
Oh, 100%, yeah. It's about a community, as you're saying, that is not a community.
Right.
They're living in the same rooms and in the same, like, on the same streets, but they're not living on the same plane.
Yeah, because their plane is social media. Or it's information.
Wherever the, yeah, it's, and ultimately the film is really about a data center being built just outside of town.
That's
and so,
right.
And so these people are, you know, killing each other based on a lot of the signals they're kind of receiving in this like feedback system.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, big things are happening right over their heads. Like they're being changed.
Yeah.
The world is being changed. And you know, and they're, and I hope that somewhere inherent in the film is this idea like that, that there is big power out there and it, you know, and there's a big problem and it's not necessarily between ourselves.
Of course.
But
it's
in the end,
dividing us.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because the basic, you know, premise of the political conflict is it's about masks on a surface, but then it's really about, you know, a corporate investment in a state that will bring jobs, bring money.
Yeah.
But the devil's bargain is that you're creating a generator for the thing that's destroying the fabric of community.
That's right. And these corporations benefit from constant engagement in these ideological arguments and in these, you know, and
anything that'll hold the eyes could be, yeah. It could be cats.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, like, look, I'm left and I, you know, like I've heard some accusations that the film is like centrist. And I think that's,
what else is the left going to say?
Yeah. that for me, it feels like a pretty bad faith, reading of the film. And I would say, you know, for me, it was important to.
It was an exploration of all sides.
Yeah, and I think it's important to like question ourselves and also look and try to find the humanity in the people that, you know, we see as against us and that we, you know, abhor. You know, that was part of the exercise for me.
Yeah.
Was like, I'm gonna try to pull back as far as I can out,
yeah,
of myself,
right,
and take as sociological a stance as possible.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, as possible, right? Because I only have my subjective point of view, and
right,
part of this was also like, you know, when I decided to start writing this in 2020, in June 2020,
yeah,
I was like, you know, in Twitter, I was like.
Yeah.
I wasn't posting, but I was retweeting.
Yeah.
I was being, you know, in some cases pressured to retweet.
Yeah.
And I started a bunch of like burner profiles.
Yeah.
Like I started a bunch, right, of just separate profiles and I got myself into different algorithms.
Yeah.
And I just took like a lot of screenshots so that I wouldn't forget anything about the moment. But,
oh, good.
But I also found like these algorithms I got myself into, I could not for the life of me get myself out of.
Wow.
And I tried. That was part of the experiment. Like, okay, now that I'm here and now that I've kind of identified myself to this, this feedback system.
Yeah.
This feedback system.
Yeah.
You know, sorry, I have a stutter. That I'm, in this case, like a Nazi,
yeah,
right? Like,
right.
Can I get out of that? No, I could not.
It just keeps coming for your brain.
Yeah, once you're there, you're stuck.
Yeah. Well, I just thought, you know, that the humanness at the core of it, the raw humanness, which is a guy that, you know, is supposedly the guy who's going to save the town, if we're going to talk about the Western, you know, an utterly impotent cowboy, you know, finds his moxie and his strength in, you know, in slander to kind of turn the tables and, you know, as a, like, fuck you, fuck all of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be this guy.
Yeah.
You know, he crossed the Rubicon of self or whatever that is and became this, you know, doubling down monster. But he still plays it with a certain amount of sensitivity that is kind of crazy.
Yeah, well, that's important.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I want the film to sort of function as like a roller coaster ride of like,
totally,
sympathy, right? You know,
jerk you around, yeah.
Yeah, where, you know.
Everybody's complicated.
And maybe you understand him in a way you don't.
Well, I think
based on whatever your politics are, right? Like maybe in the beginning, you don't want to be this close to this guy.
Yeah, but
so it might be a relief when things turn for,
yeah,
you know,
but I think that, yeah, the miracle of the movie is that all of them, you can find empathy with all of them.
Yeah.
Really.
Exactly.
You know, all the major players in the community system, you can, you know, empathize with. Now, some of them are obviously empathetic characters, but even the ones that aren't.
I wanted it to be a film that was empathic in multiple directions.
Right.
And some of those are oppositional.
And they're hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good job.
And hopefully it's funny. I hope it's funny. Did you laugh?
I did it a couple times.
Okay.
You know, but I mean, but again, you know, the it's not horror. It may be structurally a Western on some levels. It's not a comedy, but I do like when you, the ending is funny.
Yeah.
But it's horrifying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm going to have to rewatch all your movies as comedy.
Yeah.
Just out of respect for you.
I think he'll be able to find it.
No, I'm not saying it's not there, but I get very consumed with the humanity of something.
No, me too. Well, me too, you know.
And comedy is relief if the humanity is profoundly dark. You may not come up to the point of, like, laugh out loud,
yeah.
But the relief is there.
No, you laugh so you don't have to cry.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, but, yeah. Oh, believe me, yeah. The laughter that should be crying is my favorite.
And that's what's tricky is that the film is satire, but I never wanted any of the characters to be like objects of derision or, you know.
No,
certain characters are more cynical than others, but even the most cynical bad actors in the film are all looking for community. I mean,
sure.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
Some of them are, you know, pretty bad. But
yeah, it's like satire in the on the level of, do you remember that movie Walker?
Of course, by Alex Cox.
Yeah.
I love Walker.
That, you
the
know,
anachronisms of that film are so interesting.
And that's sort of like in that world of horror satire. You know, there's a lot of movies that ride a line with that. I'm a big fan of the movie Ravenous, I think.
I love Ravenous.
Yeah.
One of my favorite scores,
it's,
too.
It's,
the music
that,
of that.
That is a genius satire.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's Antonia Bird, right?
Uh-huh.
Or Antonia Bird.
Yeah.
She also made that film Priest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But Ravenous is a masterpiece. I love that film.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm always talking about especially that score, which is Michael Nyman and Damon Albarn.
Uh-huh.
It's just one of the great. That was something of a reference for the music in this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that is a satire on Manifest Destiny. I mean, it is like straight up. You know, there's nothing. It's framed as a horror movie, but I think a lot of horror movies are satire. But that thing can only be read like that, and it's funny.
Oh, it's really funny.
Yeah.
It's really bleak. It's really funny. It's really exciting.
It's hard to find.
It is hard to find. I remember seeing that in theaters in Santa Fe,
yeah.
with my friend Zach, and we were just like giddy coming out of that theater.
It's great,
so much fun.
So, in closing, how's your mom feel about your movies?
she's proud of me, and she likes the movies. She's very supportive. I think, you know, certain things she likes more than others.
Of course, yeah. You're never going to get all, you know, you're not going to get everything you need.
No, well, no, but no, I'm lucky in that sense. When Beau Is Afraid flopped,
yeah.
my dad did tell me, maybe you shouldn't write the next one.
get back on your feet.
Yeah, you might have been right. Oh, and also just a little shout to one of my best friends is Dan Clowes, and he was telling me before I came over here, like, oh yeah, Mark, that's my best conversation.
Good.
That's the best one.
Oh, good. Yeah, he's great.
He's the best.
He's great.
I love him so much.
Oh yeah, all that stuff had a profound impact on me too. Yeah, his work.
Huge. Eight Ball.
Ball. The best. Yeah.
Eight Ball was like as big to me, like for me, like as a kid, as like, you know, Kubrick or any of those guys.
Totally.
Just.
Oh yeah, some of those stories are just fucking great.
Just so great.
Yeah.
And my humor just like, you know.
It's
that's
there?
Just, well, it's just, I mean, so much of it I like kind of like found in
his
work.
Where
it's like, okay, this is what I find funny. This is what I love.
Yeah. The underground comics in general are a savior to me.
Absolutely.
Well, say hi to him for me.
I will.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. He was great, right? Yeah. Go see that movie, Eddington. It's now playing in theaters. Hang out for a minute. Folks, on Thursday's episode, I talk with my Bad Guys co-star, Awkwafina. Before that happens, you can check out my talk with another bad guy, Mr. Piranha, Anthony Ramos.
I thought about quitting because I was like, yo, this shit is too hard, man. Like,
what part of it was too hard?
Just the auditions and being I can't be in South Pacific. Ain't Misbehaving. I ain't going to be in... I'm not going to be in Carousel.
Feels like they've opened that up more now.
Now for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like now, I'm excited about.
Yeah. But then it was still kind of like, they're not going to cast.
They only started doing that shit like in the last, like, I would say 5 years.
Yeah.
Maybe,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, where they really started to be like, oh yeah, let's open it up.
Cast it. Good.
You know, but it wasn't.
Yeah,
they weren't really doing that shit.
Yeah.
for a while.
You were frustrated.
I was super frustrated, man. I was like, yo, like, you know, first three years of auditioning, I was like, yo, like, what do I have to do? Like,
well, did they tell you to act differently?
I mean, one of my teachers, and this was the teacher was just trying to help, but he was like, yo. They were like, yo, maybe if you grow your hair out, you might be a little ethnically ambiguous. You know, people won't really know your race, and then you can audition for different roles. You can also, audition for white and maybe, Arabic and Latina.
So many Arabic parts.
Right.
Good idea. You're right. I'm really missing out on what to go from Latino to Arabic. A lot more opportunity.
Oh, my gosh, bro.
Thanks for that advice.
Thanks. Thanks. Oh, fuck.
That's episode 1441 with Anthony Ramos. You can listen to that for free wherever you listen to podcasts. To get every episode of WTF ad-free, sign up for WTF Plus. You can go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some rock.
Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.